So last week we talked about the purpose of the Torah. And we kind of used the word Torah as a catch-all, without really defining the term. So let's define the term. When I use the word Torah, what am I talking about? What do you think?
An acronym, isn't it?
Torah is not an acronym, no.
No, the word Torah is not
an acronym. No, you think of something else. We'll get to it in a second. But what's the word Torah encompass? When you say you're learning Torah, what does that mean?
Isn't that the law?
The first five books.
Okay, so five books of Moses.
Chumash, the Talmud.
Right, five books of Moses, which we'd also call the Chumash, right, which is what you have in front of you. Chumash meaning, why is it called the Chumash?
Chumash.
Right, Chumash, right, because the Hebrew word for five is Chumash, right? So it's called the Chumash because there are five books. Simple enough. Okay. What else can I be talking about?
Talmud.
What else?
What is the Talmud?
We'll get to it.
Okay.
Right now we're just listing stuff. We'll get through what everything is.
The books that follow the first five books are sometimes included.
What is that referring to?
Joshua. Prophets.
Okay, so prophets, which are Nevi'im and Ketuvim. What's that, Ketuvim?
Writings.
Good,
very good.
Which are writings. Now, the acronym that's often used for Torah, prophets, and writings is Tanakh, right? Tanakh is an acronym. I love this big board. I can just go crazy. Tanakh is an acronym for Torah, tough, Nevi'im, and Ketuvim. Right, that's the Chaf Sofi. So that's where we get Tanakh from. Torah, Nevi'im, Ketuvim is that acronym kind of, you sound out the acronym, it says, sounds out as Tanakh. Okay, what else can I be referring to?
Shulchan Aruch.
Shulchan Aruch. We'll explain what that is.
What is that?
We'll explain what that is later on. Okay, the truth is we can go on forever. We're not going to. We could write the works of Maimonides, Pirkei Avot, Mishnah, the Midrash, any book in this library, you know? Well, maybe every book. I don't know if some of these biographies would count as Torah necessarily. Let's look around. The commentaries on the Chumash, the commentaries on the Talmud, the books of Jewish law, the English books that describe Jewish law or describe the get commentary in the Torah. So there's no end to it. There's no limit to it. So the reason I bring this up is to say that we have to have some sense of the history, and not just the history, but how it came to be what we have today, to really understand where Jewish learning has been and where it's gone. And I think it's important that we go through this. I don't want to be too dry and historical, but that will certainly be a part of it. But we also have to understand kind of conceptually how it evolved over time and where it is today. And I think by doing that, we'll have just a good big picture as to what Torah and Torah learning is all about. Okay, so let's start at the top. The first thing we have that we can consider Torah is the five books of Moses. What period of history does that cover?
From the beginning until we get to Canaan.
So it's creation until the precipice of entering the land of Israel, or the death of Moses. Basically, that's how the story is, right?
From creation to liberation.
To the what?
From creation to liberation.
To liberation, and beyond liberation. And you might want to take notes. You're free to take notes on this because it's gonna be a lot. Yeah,
interesting.
Yeah, that's from today's Hebrew school.
Oh.
Should we get some paper?
I could, yeah. Can I grab some?
Yeah, let's...
Sorry.
You know, can I close this?
Actually, does anyone...
Okay, so that's the five books of Moses. It starts from creation, and it goes through the death of Moses. When was it written?
A long time ago.
Within the context of the story, when is it written? I mean, it's covering a pretty long period of time. Is it written over time? Is it written all in one shot? When's it written and who's writing it?
After the Ten Commandments are received, before they enter into Israel, kind of.
Okay.
Moses writes it through God.
Okay, good. But that's a good 39-year period. Right? Because...
I like to wander.
Well, right, because from the time they get the Torah till they actually enter the land of Israel, it's about 39 years. So, but that's the right answer. It's not written all in one shot. Moses is given a lot of the laws when he goes up to Mount Sinai. When he goes up to Mount Sinai, what's he learning for 40 days? So he's learning all these laws, and he's getting the history from God. So I mean, how does Moses know about these exchanges between Adam and Eve, and Cain and Abel, and Yaakov and Sarah? How does he know about these conversations that had happened? He doesn't. He has no idea. It's God dictating to Moshe what to write and how to write. So Moshe is more of a scribe. But a lot of stories take place after he's already down from the mountain. So certainly the book of Bamidbar is predominantly stories that happen afterwards. Right? Even a lot of it in the second book of Shemot, the story of the golden calf, happens after he's coming down already. Asking God for forgiveness for the people, and then people being forgiven happens afterwards. So he's constantly writing down the Torah throughout his time until his death. And there's actually a question in the Talmud as to who writes the last few verses, because it says that Moshe dies, and then there's a few more verses afterwards. So does Moshe write and Moses died? Right? That's not so nice.
Maybe the courts did it.
Right, so it seems that the Talmud gives a different explanation, but it seems that Joshua writes it. So Joshua actually finishes it up. Yahushua finishes it up. So it's predominantly written by Moshe, and as these episodes are happening, and a lot of them are happening to him, right? They're rebelling against him, the people are complaining about this. Moshe, at the end of his life, gives this long speech, and that's the fifth book of the book of Devarim. So it's written incrementally throughout that time, but God's dictating to Moshe what to write, and Moshe writes it down. Then Moshe gives a copy, and gives that book, and they begin to make copies of it to make sure that it's disseminated. There is a law that you can only write a Sefer Torah by copying from an existing Torah. You can't do it from memory, you can't do it from a Chumash. You have to have another Torah you're copying from. Why? It guarantees that it's always going to be the same. Right? If you're always copying from an existing one, then that chain goes back all the way to the beginning. And that's where they found the Dead Sea Scrolls thousands of years ago, and the text is exactly the same. So when it comes to the Torah, we have a very strong belief that every word is written by God, every word is sacrosanct, every word is there for a purpose, the way it's written is for a purpose, and that's why we'll see the commentaries in the Talmud, which will explain what that is, will delve into every little nuance of the lettering of the words, because the belief is that everything was given from God. I had another point, but I forgot. Any questions on that before we move on? Okay.
Did Moses prophesy his own death?
He was told he was going to die. He didn't need to prophesy.
Did he prophesy that he would not enter the land of...
He was told by God, yeah. I mean, Moses had a very unique prophecy in that his... Every other prophet had prophecy when they were in a dreamlike, unconscious state. He's the only one who had prophecy in a conscious state. So he was told directly, you're not going in. So he knew, and he appeals to God, and he begs God, and he tries to negotiate with God to let him go, and it doesn't work. It doesn't
work. After the rock incident?
Right, exactly. Yeah. Right. So then he's stuck. Okay, so that's what we have to this point. Now, we talked a little bit last week as to what's encompassed within the Chumash, and there's some history, and there's some theology, and there's a lot of laws, and there's a bunch of narratives, so it's a real mix, but in totality, this is kind of the essential book of the Torah. However, there's a lot missing, right? If all we had was the Chumash, we would have a very incomplete religion. And it's interesting to note that historically, one of the biggest philosophical debates has been how literally to take the Chumash, how literally to take the text. Goes back to the Tzedukim, who were a sect in Israel who believed that you should take the Torah literally 100%. The Karaites, who were created probably around the 800s and became very prominent through the Middle Ages and had a very large community, which has pretty much died out, although I hear there's a Karaite synagogue in Daly City, which is like one of the only ones in the world. It's like 10 minutes away from here. No, really, there's like a whole, Jay had a whole story about it like 2-3 years ago, the Karaite community. I mean, it's unbelievable.
That's like equivalent to like a Chabad group, or it's
no, very different. No, very different. So, what the Karaites believe, we'll give some examples of this. The Karaites believe that the Torah should be taken literally, and that there's no oral tradition. And that's the question. The question is,
how do you spell Karaite?
Karaite is the K. It's K A R A I T E. I believe that's how it's spelled. Something like that. So this was a very powerful group, certainly in the Middle Ages, and like I said, it never really died out. So the main question they were addressing was, what does Moses receive in Mount Sinai? Does he only receive this book, this 5 books of Moses, or does he also receive more information that's supposed to be passed on as an oral tradition? So, the traditional belief, or the counter view to this, is that Moses received an oral tradition, which we'll describe and we'll get into. They believe that that was not the case, that all we had was the book. If the book says it, you do it, literally. Right? The book says an adulteress is killed, so she's killed. Well, wait a second. The Talmud describes you need witnesses. Although the Torah does talk about witnesses, talks about the scenarios where that can be. That's not really, don't take it so literally. So that's one example. Another is Shabbat, where it says, right, you shall not have a fire in Shabbat. So we understand it. So we understand that as meaning that you can't light a fire in Shabbat. They thought it meant you have to live in the dark. So they couldn't have a fire, but they made before Shabbat. And let it go throughout Shabbat. So there's a number of different examples. But they took this literally, which had a very wide-reaching effect. Especially because a lot of, like I said, the Chumash doesn't tell us a lot of very important information. So let's go through a few examples just to understand this. All right, let's go to... Page 363.
Yes.
So go to 362, pasuk tet number 9. So we'll do it Hebrew then in English. And it shall be for you a sign on your arm and a reminder between your eyes, so that Hashem's Torah may be in your mouth, for with a strong hand Hashem removed you from Egypt. What is this referring to?
Tefillin.
Right, but what's the first part? A sign on your arm and a reminder between your eyes. That is tefillin. Okay, where does it tell us that tefillin should be black and boxes and should have parchments in them?
Nope.
Should have leather straps?
It doesn't.
Doesn't say anything.
Not in here.
Not in here, yeah. Right? So, if you're a Karaite, you look at this and say, all right, we have to do a sign on my arm and a reminder between your eyes. Okay, so we'll write on, I'll write on my arm, remember the Exodus, remember the Alamo, you know? And I'll write, and I'll make a picture between my eyes, which I can't really see it, but, you know, I'll know it's there. And that will be my, then I'll fulfill the mitzvah, right? That's all the Torah says. How do we know that it's tefillin as we know it? So that's where the oral tradition comes in. That we believe that, that Moses was also given other information that was intentionally left out of the Chumash. Okay? Let's give another example.
I had a question.
Yeah.
In 10 it says, you shall observe this decree at its designated time. Is that, was that just left vague, or did they ever mention when you were supposed to wear them?
That's going back, I think, to the to Pesach. Yeah, that's going back, because earlier you were talking about Pesach. I think you were talking about Pesach. Yeah, the time that you're given to celebrate Pesach.
So, for the carrots, that's the only time you do that.
Oh, I don't know. I'm not sure if they connected it to Tefillin. It's a good question. I'm not sure. All right, let's go to.
Do the carrots use Tefillin then, or do they do something completely
different? They would do something completely different. Yeah.
Like a tattoo?
Or, there's a Karaite synagogue in the old city of Jerusalem. And, it's, you know, kind of tucked away somewhere. So I had a friend who was this real scholarly type, and, who's now finishing up his PhD in physics. He was, like, fascinated with this stuff, loved this stuff. So he convinced me to go with him to try to go into the Karaite synagogue, you know, in the old city. So I was like, all right, we're in yeshiva in the old city at the time, so we lived like a 2-minute walk away. But like no one ever went there. It was like, you know, taboo, like, oh yeah. So we went and he like just knocked on the door and someone there answered and showed us around and explained what they did and I forgot, you know, this is already going back a few years, but it was fascinating. It was still there. It was real. I mean, I always looked at this remnant of the past, and like here this guy was, and you know, they only marry within their community. They're very cloister. They, you know, they really want to retain their faith in their community. It's just a fascinating little, you know, little group. I don't remember. I think he did of some sort. I think he did actually. I think I do. I don't remember so much about the details of it. But anyway. Okay, let's go to... page 1004. So this is the commandment on shechting and how to slaughter an animal so that's kosher. So the Torah says, we'll do 20 and 21, chaf and chaf aleph. Ki yarchev Hashem elokech et gvulcha kasher diber lach v'emarta ochla basar ki ta'aveh nafshecha lecho basar bekol ava nafshecha tocho basar ki yarchak mimcha hamakom asher yivchar Hashem elokecha lasum shmo sham v'zavachta mi מבקרך ומצאונך אשר נתן השם לך כאשר ציוויסיך ובחרת בשעריך כל הבא נפשך. When Hashem your God, number 20, when Hashem your God will broaden your boundary as he spoke to you and you say, I would eat meat. So they go to Israel, they want to eat meat. For you will have a desire to eat meat. For your heart's entire desire, may you eat meat. Right? You want to eat meat? Go ahead and enjoy. If the place that Hashem your God will choose to place his name will be far from you, meaning, let's say you're far away from the temple, in the base of Middash, still you can, you know, you don't have to be in the base of Middash to slaughter meat. You may slaughter from your cattle and your flocks that Hashem has given you, as I have commanded you, and you may eat in your cities according to your heart's entire desire. Okay, so how are we supposed to slaughter an animal? How's the Torah describing how to slaughter an animal? Right? It doesn't really say. It says, "Kasher tzivisicha," right? Which is, "As I have commanded you," right? when did you command us? Commanded who? Commanded when? Commanded how? It doesn't say. It just refers to a commandment that seemingly was already given to them, but is not mentioned anywhere in the Torah. Right?
So this is the only place this is mentioned.
This is the only place this is mentioned. This really? Is the, yeah. So, again, without an oral tradition that's going to describe what this means, we don't have very much, right? Now, it's a funny way to write a book. It's a funny way to write a book that you want to be the cumulative Jewish, you know, law for all of history that everyone can always refer back to as the point, right? I mean, you don't write a law, a law book and say, oh yeah, and make sure that we keep that law that we talked about, right? That's not effective, right? That's not effective. I don't think many lawyers would want you to write it that way, right? So what does it mean? So do it the way that I told you. How are we supposed to know what that means? So this is used as a proof very often that there is some other information that was given. God gave Moses other information that he was told to pass down. To pass down first to the elders, to kind of the leaders of the people then, and then they would teach it to the Jewish people. And then there would be a system where there were always leaders whose job it was to continue to teach this tradition. But it wasn't written down. It was intentionally not written down, and it was intentionally given in a way that it was not to be written down. Let's do one more example, just to bring him up.
Then how you came up with how to slaughter an animal and what animal you can slaughter?
Well, the kosher animals it describes. That it describes elsewhere in the Torah. Oh. But the method of slaughtering it doesn't.
Then this can be altered.
What?
If it's something that's not written down, you can interpret it any way you want to.
You would think. And yet, we have a pretty universal system of slaughtering. So how is that the case? How do we have a universal... We have a pretty universal concept of what tefillin looks like.
Mm-hmm.
Even though it's not written exactly anywhere what it's supposed to look like. In the Chumash. So it seems that we all seem to agree on something that's not written anywhere in the Chumash. So how is that the case?
I don't know.
Ah, okay, so that's what we're talking about. All right, yeah, the next example, it's just reproving the point. I want to move on because I want to make sure we get this to everything I want to get to. So, this is one example. This is called something called Halacha LeMoshe MiSinai, law given directly to Moses at Sinai. So some of these oral tradition laws were given directly to Moses and he passed it down. So, tefillin is an example. Shechita, slaughtering, is an example. Lulav and Etrog is an example. It doesn't actually say Lulav or Etrog. It describes certain types of fruit. It calls it an Etrog, a pre-ate Tadar, a beautiful fruit. That's how we know that's going to be Etrog. There are lots of beautiful fruits. So, again, it's an oral tradition for Moses that's the kind of fruit that we're talking about. And yet everyone has the same Etrog. So, again, there's a lot of examples like this. I'm just giving a few pretty prominent ones. So, why would Hashem give a Torah that has an oral tradition? Why not just give it all as explicitly as possible? This way we won't have mistakes, and that's it. It's finished.
Maybe because these were just sort of an outline to remind you of what you were supposed to do.
Okay.
It serves as a reminder to the laws you're supposed to follow, but you got the oral tradition that told you what it was. And this was sort of just...
So these laws are to keep a framework for which the... But that still doesn't answer the question, why write the book that way? Why give the law that way? Why not just write it all as explicitly as possible?
I would think it could be... That's not an orthodox idea, but so it could be changed or interpreted based on the times, a little bit more flexible.
Okay, so that's one possibility. To make it more flexible, we'll get into that. Okay?
It would be huge.
It would be a really big book?
Yeah.
Okay. It'd be a really big book.
Too heavy to carry.
Too heavy. You remember, now we have books, and they had, you know, scrolls, they're writing it. It's like, oh my God. But then again, if the Torah really wanted to save space, there's a lot better ways to save space. That, you know, you can cut off a lot of genealogy. You don't need, you wouldn't cut off the one line that says, oh yeah, tefillin are black and boxes, you know? That's not going to save a ton of time.
Maybe by putting some of this into an oral tradition, it engages more people in different ways. I mean, not everybody may not be able to read the book, and you might be able to, create a community that's cohesive.
Okay.
In more than one way.
Okay, good. So this is another important part, that Judaism is not supposed to be a solitary religion, right? It's not supposed to be something you can learn on your own. If you can learn it all on your own, then it's not worth that much, right? For example, right? If example I like to give for this is if you were about to go into surgery and you met your doctor, and your doctor looks like he or she is 25, and you say, "Wow, you look a little young." He's like, "Oh, it's okay. I read all the books, right?" "Well, how many surgeries have you done?" "Well, I don't need to do any surgery. I read all the books." "Well, who are your mentors?" "I don't need mentors. I read all the books," right? You'd run for your life, right? Because you can't learn certain things just through a book. If you could learn certain things only through a book, then it's not that hard to do, right? If anyone could do it by reading a book, fine. Certain things are harder than others. And, I mean, there are books out there that, you know, I haven't become a quantum physicist, even though I'm somewhat confident if I read a lot of books I could somewhat understand it. But yeah, that's, you know, I haven't taken that on. But certainly something that's supposed to be life-altering, that's supposed to teach you lessons and values, you need role models for that. You can't just learn from a book. And it's trying to, in some ways, de-emphasize the importance of the book. As much as we're called the people of the book, the irony is it was given in a way that de-emphasized the book. Right? Not to say that this isn't the most important. This is the, you know, the foundation of what Judaism is all about, but we don't want it to be just about reading a book. Okay? So that's a very important point. And that lends itself to a lot of confusion. Because when things are handed off orally, so then there's going to be different opinions on how to interpret certain things, and there's going to be different perspectives, and there's going to be flexibility, as Malcolm was saying, and there'll be times when this group thinks this is the way it is, and if not, you're crazy, and the other group says no, it's something else, and if you think something else, you're crazy. And that's kind of the flavor of Judaism, is that it lends itself to different types of interpretations, customs, and cultures. And it's been, we talked about this at the Tuesday night, at the Three Rabbis thing last week. If you want to define Jewish culture, right? There is no Jewish culture. There's Jewish culture that you know because you grew up in a certain place. So for you, Jewish culture is bagels, lox, and Mel Brooks movies. But I promise you, for a Jew living in Syria in 1950, that was not Jewish culture, right? You gave him a lox and a bagel and said, "Hi, isn't this Jewish?" They think you're crazy, right? It's not Jewish culture. It's a combination of things that Jewish people seem to like within certain societies, right? However you define it. That's the way, you know, that's all it is. It's not. There is no Jewish culture per se, right? So to here, you don't really have, you know, it allows for a lot more flexibility. It allows for a lot more, you know, different cultures developing around it. Now, besides culture, though, we have to get to law. This is a legal system. Jewish law is a law. It's a legal system. And there is a religious legal system, but there's also a very, you know, there's a civil legal system as well. So there has to be a way of figuring out the law, otherwise you're going to be in trouble, because when, you know, living in Israel, when, you know, the Jewish people had control over their land and there was Sanhedrin in place, and if someone was accusing someone else of stealing from them, there had to be a legal system that made sense. You couldn't just be, "Well, I think it should be this. Well, I think it should be this. Oh, that's so interesting." Right? There has to be a system. So there's a system that is based on the Chumash, because you do need your core concepts, but then there's a lot that was passed down as tradition. And there were certainly different schools of thought that developed very different views on certain issues. The most famous of these, I would say, is Hillel and Shammai, right? Hillel and Shammai are kind of seen as the paradigm
different schools of thought. And the Talmud is full of stories of Hillel and Shammai in a personal sense. And also just very often the Talmud says, well, Hillel thinks this and Shammai thinks that, and then come to some sort of conclusion. So that's very common. So it's very common for Judaism to have a lot of different ways. Now, flexibility was also important, but not just flexibility, but a focus on conceptual law versus just practical law, right? Because if you look at the Talmud, the stories that you're going to read about are, my ox gores your ox, how much money do I owe you, right? Okay, so if all we're talking about is oxen goring each other, so we can just, you know, declare the book irrelevant in our times and move on. But the Talmud goes well beyond that. It gets into concepts of ownership, of liability. When am I responsible for the behavior of my possessions? Now we're getting into a lot more sophisticated discussions that can now go into car accidents and, you know, all sorts of other things, which is what we can now derive from it, because it lends itself into a conceptual discussion and not just a laundry list of laws. So the purpose of the Torah wants, Hashem wants the Torah to become a conceptual understanding, not just a laundry list of laws to follow. Okay, any questions before we move on?
Did Moses actually explicitly say that he was given the oral tradition?
In the Torah itself?
Anywhere.
The only sources we have when Moses says is the Torah, besides, you know, Midrashim that mention things he said, but we wouldn't necessarily take them as literal fact.
Well, how do we know that Hashem gave it to Moses?
I'm saying it's kind of a deductor, it's like a proof of deduction.
How
that
do we know Moses just didn't? Hashem said, it's up to you.
Is that to you?
Yeah.
Whatever you want slaughtering to be, just go ahead and slaughter that?
I mean, you've got the book, and Moses, you make up the rest.
Okay. Well, the funny thing is, we see throughout the Torah times that Moses gets things wrong. Right? Moses gets things wrong, or Moses doesn't know the law and has to ask God after the fact. Or Moses thinks something is a law, and then God corrects him and says, no, Aaron was right. No, you, yeah.
So we know it for a fact that...
I'm saying the Torah does not treat Moses as the all-knowing. They didn't treat Moses as the all-knowing sage. They assumed that he would get it right because he got it from the source, but they question him. You know, there's a great example where typically inheritance went through the sons. So there was a case of a family with four daughters. That happens from time to time. a family with all daughters, and the question was, who should inherit the land? And there's a whole discussion, can daughters inherit? And Moses thought no, and the name, they're called the Benot Salafchad, daughters of Salafchad, challenged Moshe and said, we think you're wrong. We think actually the law would be that daughters can inherit if there's no sons. So Moses asked God, and he said, no, they're right. You're wrong, Moshe. They can inherit it, and they inherit the land. So,
Was not based on oral tradition. That was based on the...
No, it was based on his understanding of what the laws of inheritance were. And
The laws of inheritance are not part of the oral tradition. It's part of the written law.
Every aspect of the written law has aspects of the oral tradition as part of it. You know, I mean, Shabbat's in the Torah, but it doesn't say where the 39 categories of work are. It doesn't say what you can and can't do on Shabbat except a few minor things. They're very, you know, it says fast on Yom Kippur. Can I eat something? Can I eat a little bit? What if I'm sick? You know, like, you need all sorts of... You can't get to every type of scenario just with the written text. It's impossible. Right? I mean, we see that with the Constitution, right? The Constitution was written. I'm sure they thought it was pretty all-inclusive. And, you know, it lends itself to hundreds of years of debate, which is healthy debate. What were the founding fathers' intent? Right? What did they mean? Right? They would never have imagined this, that, or the other thing. Right? It was well beyond what they could have imagined.
Right.
So, you have to try to figure out what the intent was, what the context is, what is meant by certain things, and then apply it to new scenarios and new situations.
So, So the subsequent rabbinical laws are part of the oral tradition?
We didn't get to those yet. Let's hold off. It's a good question. Let's hold off.
Because, you know, Sabbath and fasting on Yom Kippur and all this and Kashrut, that's later.
It becomes part. But the Torah gives the rabbis the authority to make new law when necessary, within a certain context. They can't change the law, but they can add a stricture if they feel like it's necessary to avoid the Torah law being broken. So the Torah gives permission, you know, it explicitly lays out that they can do that.
Isn't that sort of one of the commandments? If it's not mentioned in the Torah, you have to figure it out for yourself.
Where does it say that?
I heard that. I'm not sure if that came later or if that was actually in.
Figure out for yourself, but you have to use the tools.
But okay. I'm trying to distinguish that later rabbinical law, which became part of oral tradition, from the actual oral tradition given to Moshe at the Sinai.
Right. Yeah, you're right. Those are two separate things. You're right. There is oral tradition that explains the mitzvah and the Torah themselves, and then there's rabbinical laws that are later inventions that are instituted for different reasons depending on the scenario. But in some ways they're intertwined because rabbinic law is an extension of Torah law. Meaning, a lot of things are just pure rabbinic inventions. The holiday of Purim, the holiday of Hanukkah, right? They can't be in the Torah. They happened well after the Torah was sealed. So, and yet, they become part of Torah. It's considered learning Torah if you read the Megillah. We have discussions in the Talmud about how to light your candles on Hanukkah, which one to light first, Purim, you know, how to read the Megillah, can you read the Megillah only in Hebrew, can it be written in another language, can you read another language, can you read it by heart, I mean, you know, all sorts of discussions, but it's all based on rabbinic law. They couldn't have been in the Torah. So there's a certain amount of authority that was given to the sages to add to the law when necessary, even create new things that were deemed necessary at the time. Right. Now, it's a difficult thing. You know, we don't really have that authority today. That authority, I mean, that was still in the time of the Beis Hamikdash, of a Sanhedrin, of a more established, centralized Jewish legal system that could make, you know, new innovations like that. Nowadays, it's too splintered. I mean, you could try, but, you know. But there's clearly examples of certain communities taking on new laws. I mean, Ashkenazi Jewry forbids polygamy and you know, the year 1000. Right in the year 1000, the Sephardic community never did. Right? That wasn't part of their culture. They never took that on. So, and there's a number of examples like that. Different customs that develop. Right? Can you eat on Pesach? Can you eat corn and beans and rice on Pesach? Right? So Ashkenazim took that on. Sephardim didn't. They still haven't. How it, you know, the Torahs look, right? You've seen a Sephardi Torah versus an Ashkenazi Torah. They have very different looks to them, how they're situated, right? The Sephardi Torahs are the R2-D2 Torahs. Have you ever seen a Sephardi Torah? It's very interesting. So yeah, totally different. They don't read it, put it down. It's got a hard outer shell, and it stands up. They read it, it's standing vertically, and they twist these things, and that's what moves the Torah. Totally different way of, you know, how it looks. So there's a lot of new, you know, new things that develop over time, and certain communities have developed all sorts of different customs. You know, even within the certain, you know, even Ashkenazi Jewry, German Jews had a lot of their own customs. Still do. French Jews had some of their own customs. Italian Jews had their own customs. So, you know, that's just kind of, you know, it's what makes it complicated, but what makes it beautiful. Okay, so given simultaneously was the oral law and the written law. In Hebrew, this is referred to, and these are very commonly used terms, Torah Shebichtav. Shebichtav, right? That's Torah that's written from the Hebrew word katav. And Torah Shebe'al Peh. Shebe'al
I'll do my best I can with this. That means oral or Torah that's by heart. But Alpe means doing something by heart. It means it's oral. Now, we talked about Tanakh. So let's just finish up the Tanakh. So we had the five books of Moses. And the next step is the Nevi'im. Right? Is the prophets. So here, if you want to get a sense of Tanakh, so this is the art scroll Tanakh, which goes from beginning to end with an English translation but very little commentary. I think it's got a pretty good timetable on the back here, yeah. Okay, so the period of the yeah, so it's roughly about 2500 to 3300 in Jewish years. Which is, let's see, we're 5770. So 1, right? It's roughly 2000 years, right? So 37, what's well, roughly 3770 is year zero of the Common Era. Okay, so roughly that's so we're talking here about 1200 BC to 400 BCE. That's the time of the prophets. It's roughly the time of the prophets. Starting with Joshua, from literally the moment they entered the land of Israel to conquer it, until the destruction of the first temple. That's basically the time period that makes up the prophets. So that's your window. Yeah. And then after that, we have the writings, the Ketuvim. Ketuvim are an interesting combination. The prophets are mostly historical. So it's giving us the history from this time period. Very little that's philosophical or theological, except if it's playing out in the narrative itself. So here we get into Joshua, the conquering of the land of Israel, and then really their life in Israel, the beginning stages that they're trying to form a government and the different leaders that they had, Samson and Samuel and all these people. Then once the first kings are come around, King Saul, King David, King Solomon, their time period, the building of the first temple, and then some of the later prophets, which deal with the downfall and of the society, and which led to the destruction of the first temple, that's kind of later prophets, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, Isaiah. So that's all encompassed within the prophets. The beginning prophets are a little easier to read. The second prophets get into like prophecies and they talk more, a little more flowery. The beginning prophets are more giving us the story. So these were written, these are considered to have been written prophetically, so they have an aspect of being part of the Torah. There's kind of a sanctity to it, but it's not considered as important as the Torah. The prophets do not discuss Jewish law, do not create Jewish law. It's actually a rule, and a rule in Jewish law is that the prophets cannot introduce new laws. They can introduce new customs that were going on that maybe became part of Jewish law later on, but it can't change or add anything to the actual Torah. So it has more of a historical perspective. The writings are a combination of two things. Some of them are things that happen after the destruction of the first temple. The story of Ezra, the story of Daniel, that's happening after the destruction of the temple. Of Esther, that's also happening afterwards. And a lot of it is Divrei Hayamim, Chronicles, and a lot of it is not history, but now it's philosophy and theology. So Proverbs, Mishlei is in here, and King Solomon's writings are in here. Is Kohelet, is it Ecclesiastes,
Shir HaShirim, Song of Songs. These are all in Ketuvim, and it says a mixture of, you know, if it was something that was written in the time of the prophets, but it wasn't history, it was more philosophy or something, or poetry even. So then it gets into the writings. Or if it's historical, but post-destruction of the first temple, then it gets put into the writings as well. Job is in the writings. Or you can go look through it and get a good sense of it. But that's basically how it is. Tehillim, Psalms is in the writings. Again, that's written mostly by King David, but since it's not historical, it's put into the writings. Okay, so this is called Tanakh. In Bible studies classes, they call it the canon. That's the big term you'll see. The canon. What is in the canon? Why isn't this book in the canon? Right? So, the canon is certainly cut off once the Second Temple's been built, then it's over. Right? Anything happening in the Second Temple period and beyond is no longer in Tanakh. Is it A? Maybe it's an N. Something like that.
Oh, it's
no longer in Tanakh. The Second Temple period is no longer in Tanakh. So therefore, the story of Hanukkah, for example, happens during the time of the Second Temple. So it is not, is no longer in Tanakh. Now, there are writings about the story of Hanukkah called the Maccabees, which serve a historical purpose, but don't have any sanctity to it, quote-unquote. Not considered part of the Torah, they're considered a historical account from that time, which many people use, and a lot of people, you know, use a number of different ways. It just doesn't get into this. Okay, so anything that happens, anything that's written down historically after this point, is just that, it's just history. It's not in the actual Tanakh.
Have those been preserved?
Yeah, I mean, there's always questions on to how accurate they are, and how they haven't been tainted or changed. But yeah, I mean, Maccabees is learned. It's a fascinating book. If you haven't actually read the book of Maccabees as Hanukkah is approaching, it's a very good read to really understand the story in a much broader sense. You can find it online in English translations, and, you know, it's very, it's not that long, but it's very, very interesting. Okay, what time do we have now that my clock is broken?
9.
Is it already 9 o'clock?
Yeah, but you started 10 minutes late.
I did. Okay, let's go for 10 more minutes or so. Okay, so after the Second Temple, Jewish learning doesn't stop, and the oral tradition has remained an oral tradition. It remains an oral tradition until the destruction of the Second Temple, and really after the destruction of the Second Temple. The destruction of the First Temple was a very short amount of time, right? The Second Temple was destroyed, and 70 years later, the second one is rebuilt. And during that time, Jews aren't venturing out too far. They're predominantly in, you know, they're in Persia. The whole Purim story takes place between the first and second temple. So they're in Persia, they're in Egypt, they're in the area. And there's not, you know, there's a concern, but I guess there's somewhat of a confidence it's going to be rebuilt. So the oral tradition remains an oral tradition. After the second temple is destroyed, by the Romans, now the Jewish leadership is getting a little bit more concerned that there might not be a third temple being rebuilt so far. It was good foresight, because here we are 2,000 years later, so a little longer than those 70 years the first time around. So there was a real concern that the oral tradition, which had remained pretty consistent because Jews had lived together and hadn't ventured out too far, was now going to be lost. Jews were starting to venture out. They hadn't really made their way to Europe in large numbers, and really wouldn't for another, you know, till the turn of the next millennia. But it was starting to happen. Israel was becoming more and more sparsely populated by the Jew, by Jews, and there was no longer a real sense of a central leadership. Now, really, the center of Jewish life really transfers from to Babylonia instead of Israel. But they begin to write down the oral tradition. And that's, it starts with something called the Mishnah. The Mishnah is compiled around 200 CE by Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, or Rabbi Judah the Prince.
Sorry, Rabbi Babylon is like Turkey? What area is it?
Iraq, I think, is the...
Okay.
Iran, Iraq. Yeah, Iran, Iraq, that's Babylonia, right?
Iran is Persia.
Iran's Persia, so Iraq is Babylonia.
Sure.
Yeah. Okay.
In Babylon, that's where is back. A city today, still today.
Okay, so more, okay. So that's around 200 CE. What he does, Rabbi Yehuda Nasi was still living in Israel, and we still know his burial place is today. So he was the Nasi, that Nasi means like the president, the leader. So he was one of the last centralized formal leaders of the Jewish community in Israel for a long time. And he saw the writing on the wall, and he asked all the leading scholars, you know, every scholar, you know, basically had their own yeshiva, their own school. So they asked each school to kind of give them as much information they have as to their oral traditions, their laws, their customs. And he took all that information and compiled it into the Mishnah, which was broken up into different, you know, six different units, but then within each unit, a lot of different tractates. And he made it as concisely as possible and just did Jewish law. The one exception really was Pirkei Avot, Ethics of the Sages, which is also part of the Mishnah, which is where he compiled their ethical and philosophical writings, mostly ethical writings as well. But predominantly the Mishnah is Jewish law, but it's written very tersely. It is, you know, Rabbi Akiva says this, Rabbi Meir says this, and Rabbi Yehuda says this, the Chachamim, the sages say this, and then end, you know? So it's very, very, very terse, very concise. It was written that way on purpose. His point was, he didn't want to lose the essence of it, he didn't want to lose the actual laws, but he also wanted to maintain the teacher-student relationship that would be necessary to learn it, because it didn't give a lot of information. You still needed a lot of background. So that's why he wrote it the way it did. For the next 350 years, they continued to... to 550. The Mishnah is used as the central text in order to learn Jewish law. And then these conversations that happened during that time period becomes the Gemara. So the Gemara is predominantly based on the Mishnah. But now they begin, and they're writing this around 550 CE. Was compiled by two people, Rav Ina and Rav Ashi. Rav is, you know, Hebrew, is for rabbi. So the two of them now take all these conversations, which then now they then compile, and they use it to understand the Mishnah, the conceptual underpinnings of the Mishnah, the verses in the Torah that laws are based on. And then they start to add in history. The history of the Second Temple period, especially, is found predominantly in the Gemara. Philosophy, theology, medical advice. I mean, stories of the rabbis of the time. You name it. Everything. The Talmud has just got everything in it. The Gemara. The Talmud is a combination of these two. So the Talmud is... Talmud equals a book that has... Mishnah plus Gemara. That is the Talmud. And the reason the Talmud is such a central book in Jewish tradition is that it is the essence of the oral law. And the oral law is the predominance of Jewish law, plus all this other stuff, the history and the philosophy and the ethics. So it just becomes the central book for Jewish tradition. And that's why it becomes so important.
What do those words mean? Like the English translation, Mishnah, Gemara, Talmud?
Yeah, Gemara means to teach, and Mishnah basically means to learn. Shana is to learn. So that means to learn, that is to teach. That's what it's based on.
And the word Talmud?
Talmud, like, I think it's like from the Talmud, like a student. So it's like the student, the thing that we learn from.
The textbook.
The textbook, right? In Hebrew, right? A student is a Talmid. So, yeah, like the student's book. That's good of putting it. Okay.
boy. All right, let's stop here. Any questions to this point? Maybe we'll spend some time next week. Wasn't planning on it, but it probably wasn't realistic to do this all in one shot. So we'll do a little bit more about this next week. Any questions on this before we stop?
So where does Kabbalah
fit in? Okay, so I didn't get into that, but around the time of the Mishnah, there's many other books that are compiled. Okay, it's not just the Mishnah. The Mishnah is basically what we have on Jewish law, but there's something called the Midrash, right? The Midrash is also a collection of writings around that time. Some of them deal with Jewish law, but a lot of them deal with interpreting or
fairy tales.
Yeah, I mean, fairy tales is the right word, but it's it's filling in gaps in the narratives of the Chumash in very interesting ways. And again, not something you should take as literal or as fact, because what?
Fables, you mean kind of like?
You know, a lot of the stories, you know, the story that Avraham, you know, the story that Avraham destroyed his father's idols, right? And then told him when the other idols did. You've heard that story?
I
don't know. I'll put it this way. There's a lot of stories that get passed down as part of the essence of the story, of the storyline of the Chumash, that are not actually in the Chumash, but are based on Midrash. Because there's, you know, just as there's a lot of gaps in the Jewish law, there's a lot of gaps in the stories, right? There's large gaps in the stories. So the Midrash starts to fill those in. They can't all be true because there's a lot of disagreements on certain things, you know. How old people were, what people did, when certain things happened. So there's a lot that's left to... So there's different types of Midrash. Some deal more with Jewish law, kind of similar to a Mishnah. A lot deal with the stories and some philosophy as well. Kabbalah is a whole other world.
Isn't it just a commentary on the Torah, Kabbalah?
It is, but it's a lot more than that. The Zohar, the major book of Kabbalah is called the Zohar. The understanding is that it's written by Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, who was around the time of the Mishnah, right? The Roman time period. So it's a question of, did he write the Zohar, or was he the compiler of the Zohar? Meaning he was the Rabbi Yehuda Nasi of the Zohar. He was the king of Kabbalah. It's a great name, by the way. The king of Kabbalah. And he was like the expert on Kabbalah. So he took all the mysticism and he compiled it into a book. It's written in Aramaic. And it's written as a commentary to Chumash, but we'll throw in tons of other stuff that are not necessarily in the Chumash explicitly. Those are the major things from that time period. Now, there's a lot. It's interesting what happens to all the stuff Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi doesn't use in the Mishnah. Right? There's a lot of other. He takes all these writings, he compiles it, and he picks what he wants. What does he do with the rest? So the rest he get put into other compilations. There's Tosefta. There's Breita, and the Talmud actually had that information, and very often the Talmud will quote other writings from this time period that don't make the Mishnah. There's a whole discussion as to what to do with that information. But it's seen as having plenty of authority. It just didn't make Rabbi Yehuda Nasi's cut for whatever reason. We don't know exactly why he picks exactly what he picks, and you know, what his methodology was. But this becomes very... This becomes the benchmark for all other Jewish law. Now, I should add, there are two Talmuds. There's the Babylonian Talmud and there's the Jerusalem Talmud. Babylonian Talmud is written in Babylonia, the Jerusalem Talmud is written in Israel. Interestingly enough, the Babylonian Talmud becomes the authoritative Talmud and not the Jerusalem Talmud. Mostly because the majority of scholars were living in Babylonia at the time, so it became known as the one the real scholars were putting together is also what they were learning, and it was edited better, and it's been used a lot more, so there's a lot more commentary on it. So the Jerusalem Talmud is used, but it's very, very hard to use. There's a lot of disputes as to different text variations, and it's a very messy text. It's not very easy to read through.
Is there a lot of overlap, though, between?
Sometimes there's a lot. Sometimes there's strong overlap, but sometimes there's very different perspectives on things. I mean, I'm not an expert on Jerusalem Talmud, but I haven't done that much of it. But it's out there, you know. And I think ArtScroll recently finished, or is finishing a translation on it. They're kind of running out of stuff to translate. So
is it the Talmud that has been translated into Hebrew, or there's some? I just remember reading of the J.
Oh, the sounds. Is it the Steinsaltz thing?
Yeah, something.
Yeah, well, we have some of his. Yeah, that's what this is. The Talmud's been translated into Hebrew into all sorts of things. He has a commentary. I believe that's what this is, right? Yeah, that's what this is. So he has the he has no commentary. He did a lot of things that were different. He restructured this page. But there's lots of English translations. The Sansino is like the classic translation from like the 40s and 50s. The Art School is a more modern translation. At this point, you can get anything in the Talmud you want, have access to it. You can go online and go to certain websites, click on the page of Talmud that you want, and just listen to someone explain it for you. You know, I mean, it's easier today than it's ever been in human history. It's probably only going to get more accessible and easier. Well, it's easier to get access to it. It's not any easier to really do it right. Like a lot of things. You can do it on a very superficial level very easily. But to really get it, you know, you've got to really spend the time and the effort. Okay. So...